It's really exciting to be here for this historic U.S. Senate debate. My name is Rhonda McBride. I'm with KTVA Channel 11. I host the Frontiers program. But it is our understanding that this is the very first debate ever held above the Arctic Circle. So we are so grateful to be here in Barrow. We have a number of people to thank for making this happen. The Inuit Arctic Business Alliance, the North Slope Borough School District for letting us use this wonderful facility at the Barrow High School, as well as KBRW and KONOM and other public radio stations carrying this debate, and KTVA Channel 11 streaming on Facebook. So this is a very different kind of debate. I've moderated a number of them over the years, and usually you get just one or two questions about the Arctic or rural Alaska. So this is wonderful to have an hour and a half to explore some of these issues that desperately need attention. So true to rural Alaska style, we will begin with a prayer in Inupiaq by Ida Olimon. Thank you, Ida. Can you come forward and give us the blessing to begin?
Hello. We are down here in guarding. We are managed to live in a kite. And okay, which we own make, listen, man make, hunger sing make. All the rich, I took some marrow with it. So the Ilvich in a luck to our Lwich. Emma Inuk Yuvaluaman Savin Man Anir Ilinun Kibiak Yamasu Ribut Anuki Ilvich Kisivich Avla Rarutin Supayati Sulisunapayara Savangam Migin Luna Pilaich Pareo Sunapayarak Sabakahlu in your Leon Ritting. I see the Lurira out in your Rukran exuit, and okay, Okaluik Sark between a bit Kunerati would. The Lurira out in Suna in a lung near up to you. Small would gear Arlu, the way a car out in Agalan Ilvich. I see Ilingnun Makua Nunakpakut. We had to give Lewich, Lewich Kaisatin, Nalak Dwartatin. As he sully, Sunapayara Ilvich, Angalasimakapu, Lignun Ulu Rami, Yetrosrik Suakamna, Unisan, Atumasukikput, Hanoki Ilvich, Enarwinya Ignine Minyarifsuit. Asi nunakpakput ilwich siburliok sa akin. Kuwa maninyak tuwalo. Kahit kibot ilignun, sulit kanayak pagtuwat. Kaya narip tingin kiga sa kinyak, sa kinyalitsok. Inyok miningit liyo, panukit kaluangaman. Asi ilignun kisiyanik. Kuya takaktuwat. Anoki sunapayarak igilagaluaman. Ijakagaluak up down ni, ijiwagaluak up down ni, apikarikapta iligning. Supayarak ilvich, kaichuin. Asi, rayanarikwin. Wa sulikai road, emalunalani road, ilignun kaitibut. Aulad diluat aksaritin ilawi angit utar tay silu inyo. Ikrakak islutalo lutwa kaman ikhlek tubut kalu tamatlu but kau nakuting ni nama surut. Asi ilwit suli nariukun mig ay chokta ijia kakalu awta. Jesus at kagun apirigip tingin. Amen.
Koyanakpak.
And now for the Pledge of Allegiance. Also in Inupiat, we have Michelle Kaliak, a student here at the Barrow High School. And we also have another person. And also, a Sepetuak will be doing the Pledge of Allegiance in English. So we begin with Michelle Kaliak.
Kuchik sore nariha, takuyat, nalu nalu tawira, atau sinunara, nanat amerikami. Kuchik sore lugulu, angalat chinek, sivanirironga, atau siro, nanapak, kanga katani, gaidim. Ilangak kanang echa, ataniritikak dot, sili, angalat chisakak dot, ativluich, inuich.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. To the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you very much. It's nice to have a distinctly rural flavor to this forum. We want to explain a little bit about how this debate came to be held here in Barrow. And so we have Megan Alvana Stimple. She is the executive director of the Inuit Arctic Business Association. And in fact, she's the very first director. So we have history made on two counts today.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here. Welcome to the city of Iqaluit. My name is Megan Alvana Stimple. I'm a King Islander from Nome, Alaska, and we're honored that this is able to happen today because not only are we here in Inupiaq homelands, but it's a region that's important to the future of this state. And with this debate, we want to remind Alaskans that this region is important to our nation and our world. So we're grateful that you can all make it to bring this discussion here.
All right, thank you very much. And Megan is going to join me up here on the stage. She's going to be our official timekeeper for our forum today. And I wore my special ivory ulu today. Baleen and Ivory Ulu, as a reminder that I will cut people off if they go over their time. I thought it was a very appropriate choice in jewelry. But let me go over some of the rules of engagement here. We will give you an allotted time. It will vary depending on the question. But one of the things that we will do is we will hold up this 15-second warning sign, which means you have 15 seconds to wrap things up. And then you want to give us the alarm here when you're over? Ah, come on, we gotta give it. If it gets really loud like this, it means your time is definitely up. So with that said, we're going to begin this debate with opening statements. And what I will do is we'll just go from one end to the other, and then we'll rotate who starts first as we go through this. So Ray Metcalf, who is the Democratic candidate, you have 2 minutes for an opening statement.
For those that by chance remember, I'm effectively your anti-corruption candidate. I have a long history of exposing corruption within our political system around Alaska. And if you remember Bill Allen and the owner of VECO, he was paying off legislators to keep your oil taxes well below what international norms are. We wouldn't be broke today if we hadn't put up with 30 years of bribery. And, you know, there was a time when I was looked at as the Don Quixote of Alaska because I kept saying, hey, they're taking bribes. They're giving away your money. They're giving away Alaska's future. Well, you all know that you just got your dividends cut in half, and this is largely the reason. In 2006, I persuaded the FBI to come up to Alaska. They brought over 100 agents when they came in and raided Alaska's legislative offices. They served 23 search warrants. There were six legislators that were convicted of taking bribes to keep your oil taxes low. And during that 6 years that it took the oil companies to get regain control of your legislature, we saved up $16 billion because we were suddenly getting more for our oil. the profits of the higher prices for oil would have gone to the oil companies had that change not taken place. And so I've had a major impact on Alaska. And by the way, and that's the money we're living off. You hear we're spending down money today? That's the money that we're spending down. It's the money we saved up during that 6 years. So if you think corruption affects your life, whether it's you think you're being left out of the corporations that should be more inclusive, or left out in one more thing to bring up before my 15 seconds runs out, I was the co-author of the marching orders or the investment strategy for the permanent fund investment.
All right, thank you. Ray Metcalf, Democratic candidate. We go to the incumbent, Republican Lisa Murkowski. 2 minutes.
Rhonda, thank you. Megan, thank you as well. And thank you for focusing this forum on the Arctic, its people, its opportunities, as well as its challenges. This is an historic event, and I appreciate that that we are here above the Arctic Circle here in Utqiagvik. We're still getting used to saying the name here, but it is a reflection, again, of the importance, the significance of our First Peoples that have led in so many different ways. We talk about the Arctic and the role that the United States has as an Arctic nation. We're an Arctic nation because of Alaska, because of us. And to many, we are this remote, faraway place full of ice and snow and this pristine, untouched land that exists perhaps just in the imagination of many, a place to be preserved in time. But we know that the Arctic is so much more. The time that we spent this morning over at the Barrow Hospital, brought about in combination with IHS through a joint venture, it is a world-class facility. It's what we're seeing with the telecommunications. Maybe not quite yet, we're at 4G, but we're looking forward to greater broadband access and capabilities that will allow us to be doing so much more. What we have at Ilaksavik with our training, what we have right here at Barrow High School, the business acumen, the leadership that we have coming from so many in the area. But we also know it's a place of great challenge. Legacy wells that were left by our own government, coastal erosion brought about by the fall storms due to the warming climate, drugs and alcohol, the challenges that we're seeing within the court systems. These are challenges, but this is a resilient people, a resilient area, and I look forward to the discussion that we'll have today to bring out just these issues. Thank you.
Thank you. And we go now to our next candidate, Brett Craig, who is running as an independent. 2 minutes.
Thank you, Megan, and thank you, Rhonda, and thank you to the Inuit Arctic Business Alliance for inviting me here for this historic event. It's a real honor. I am a citizen candidate. I've never run before. I'm running because I'm concerned about what's going on. As an independent, unaffiliated candidate, I'm hoping to represent the majority of Alaskans who are actually registered, unaffiliated, independent voters. They are not Republicans or Democrats. I'm a technologist by trade, a senior program manager, a professional project manager. I work with broadband internet solutions for rural Alaskan schools. I've been to Barrow on two or three occasions as a volunteer for First Lego League Robotics, which I'm a big supporter of. It's an honor to be here. As an environmentalist and a new co-founder of the Alaskan Ocean Cluster, which is modeled on the extremely successful Icelandic Ocean Cluster private-public partnership, I'm really honored to be part of what we can do in the Arctic to fix things and to go forward. I also have an MBA, so I'm a businessman who's got a lot of experience globally. I've worked in Africa for World Bank and other non-government organizations on large multi-billion dollar broadband systems, so I know what it takes to do major infrastructure builds to bring them in successfully, and I recognize the challenges. I want to make one promise to all Alaskans, and especially to first Alaskans, that when I'm your U.S. Senator, no one will own me. I'm an independent, and I will work every day to bring it home for Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you, Brett Craig. And we now go to another independent candidate, Margaret Stock. 2 minutes.
Thank you for hosting the first U.S. Senate debate on the Arctic. I'm very happy to be back in Utqarevik, formerly known as Barrow. It's been 30 years since my first trip up here. Thinking about the debate over the last few days, I have come to the conclusion that we debating up here, we candidates, will probably agree on lots of things. I think we'll agree that the federal government should be paying more attention to the Arctic. I think we will agree that the federal government should be increasing its research on the effects of climate change on subsistence, on resource development, and on national security in the Arctic. I think we will agree that the federal government should be building more icebreakers, for example, although it is way, way behind on that score. But what I don't think we will agree on are the bigger issues. And those bigger issues will ultimately determine whether we have an effective, functioning federal government with the resources to do the things that we all agree need to get done. If our senators won't work effectively to pass bills and get money for what Alaska needs, and won't hold hearings and vote on judges and administrators, if our senators won't pass appropriations bills, if we have a major political party that is committed to obstructionism and denying science, then whatever we agree on here simply will die due to congressional gridlock. Likewise, research costs money, icebreakers cost money, navigational aids cost money, and if you have a political party that is dedicated to austerity and cutting taxes for the wealthy, then we're not going to have the resources to do the things that I expect we will all agree here that we need to get done. So you need to take a look at Republican Party candidate Trump. He says he is a billionaire. Think about that. He's worth more than $1,000 million, but he apparently didn't pay any federal income taxes for 20 years. A country with that type of tax code, which so heavily favors the wealthy, is not going to have the resources it needs to pay for all the things we are going to agree that we need. So we need to keep in mind the pressing needs of the Arctic, and we need to make Congress function well enough to meet those needs.
Okay, thank you
so much. I look forward to the debate.
And what might happen if some of you run overtime is I might wind up giving time to the other candidates to keep things fair. But Margaret, since you touched on the presidential race and everybody across the country is focused on that, I would like, beginning with Senator Lisa Murkowski, to look at the pros and cons of who becomes president. Pros and cons in terms of the Arctic. 1 minute.
The philosophy that we are seeing repeated from the Democratic nominee, Mrs. Clinton, that we need to keep our oil resources in the ground, is a philosophy and an approach that will not only hold back the Arctic, it will hold back Alaska, it will hold back the country. So when you think about the pros and cons of this election and the leadership that will move forward, focusing on energy and energy development and our opportunities to develop our onshore, our offshore, our minerals, our resources, this is something that we all need to factor into our calculus here.
And just one quick follow-up question, one-word answer necessary only. Which candidate do you favor as president at this point? Who will you vote for?
I do not favor either of the nominees.
And you won't say who you'll vote for?
I do not favor Mrs. Clinton, and I do not favor Mr. Trump.
Okay, we'll go on to the next candidate, Brett Craig. Same question. What are the pros and cons of a Trump versus Clinton presidency?
Just right off the bat, I don't think Donald Trump's a viable candidate.
And just to clarify, focusing on the Arctic
right.
as well.
And I don't think he's a viable candidate for the Arctic because, A, I doubt seriously he knows anything about it. And unless he can put a hotel here, he probably will have no interest in knowing anything about it. But with that said, I have serious reservations about, Secretary Clinton. I know that she's taken a very strong stance on Anwar and what's perceived by many to be an anti-drilling platform. I believe I can work with her. I believe that I can convince her, as an oil brat myself, raised in an oil family, that I can work with the next president of the United States to get the drilling rights and the expedited permitting we need to open up more of our resources.
So, Brett Craig, which candidate would you support for president? Who are you going to vote for?
I'm going to vote for Hillary Clinton.
All right, thank you very much. Margaret Stock, same question.
Well, I've said publicly I don't think Donald Trump is fit to be president of the United States. I am voting for Hillary Clinton. I do agree with her on many issues, including women's reproductive rights, the need to make college affordable, and opposing Republican plans to turn the Medicare program into a complicated and inadequate voucher system. I don't think she will be a disaster for the Arctic or for Alaska at all. The same thing was said about the Obama administration. For 8 years, we've been getting told that President Obama would be an absolute disaster for the Arctic, and he has been very supportive of Alaska Native interests and concerns. The Obama administration also approved drilling permits in NPRA and the Chukchi Sea. The Obama administration has sent substantial climate mitigation funds to Alaska. The huge problem we're facing right now results from the low oil prices. And it wasn't the Obama administration that shut down natural resource development, but a flood of natural resource production under the Obama administration that drove down the price of oil. I don't think it's good for Alaska to have two senators from the same political party who are committed to obstructing, embarrassing, and delegitimizing the president.
All right, thank you. Your time is up. Same question, Ray Metcalf, 1 minute.
I think that this election is enormously important in the sense that there are appointments going to be made in the Supreme Court that are going to outlive everyone in this room. If Trump is appointed, you're going to have judges that are not sympathetic to Native issues. You're going to have judges far more sympathetic to environmental issues, Native issues, if Hillary is the successor. And by the way, I promised never to make a reservation at a Trump Tower in Barrow, so as far as who I'm going to vote for, I was a Bernie Sanders candidate or supporter, and I'm going to reluctantly vote for Hillary because I do have some issues with her, but that Supreme Court is very, very important to everyone in this room.
Thank you very much. And one thing I did neglect to mention, that Joe Miller, a Libertarian candidate, was invited to this debate, but did not accept the invitation. So we do have an additional Senate candidate here. So moving on to the subject of national security, and we will begin this round of questions with Brett Craig. Traditionally, the Arctic has been seen as a region for peace and cooperation. I mean, we all remember the Russian icebreakers that helped bring fuel to the Renda in Nome. That was one of those rare moments of wonderful cooperation. But we're seeing the Russians showing more signs of aggression. Should we take this seriously? 1 minute.
Absolutely. I think the Russians and their allies, communist-controlled China, are very aggressively pressuring and moving into the Arctic. I believe they have plans to leverage their power in the Arctic as quickly as possible before we can get up to speed. We have some serious security concerns up here that need to be addressed immediately. We need to get advanced naval bases up here and U.S. Coast Guard bases in the Arctic, now. We need to bake, borrow, and steal the icebreakers we need to cover our side of the Arctic. We are the gatekeepers to the western end of the Northwest Passage, and we have nothing up here to protect us. Our closest U.S. Coast Guard base is 800 miles away in Kodiak. It's not an acceptable situation. I don't know how we got here, but we've got some big work to do. quick.
All right, thank you very much, Brett Craig. And we go on to Margaret Stock. And the question is the importance of the Arctic as far as military security go, and should we take the threat of Russian aggression seriously?
Well, we should take it seriously. We've noticed significant movement by the Russian government to increase their military resources in the Arctic. And that, of course, should be a concern to the United States because we are an Arctic nation. However, we have neglected the Arctic for far too long. There are significant things that the Pentagon would like to see done in the Arctic, including the United States ratifying the Law of the Sea Treaty. Senator Murkowski has been in power for more than two terms and has done nothing to advance the Law of the Sea Treaty, although the Pentagon has asked for it. The Russians are reaching out now through the Law of the Sea regime and trying to lay claim to significant resources in the Arctic. We need to work on that. I concur with much of what Breck has said in terms of the need to fund more icebreakers. We're not going to see a new icebreaker in place for many, many years. So I think we have neglected the Arctic. We need to be strong, and we also need to be vigilant.
All right, same question. Ray Metcalf, 1 minute.
Well, the Russians are on the Siberian side. I recently heard in the news that they have under construction or in place 50 new and existing military facilities up and down the Siberian coast. And you've already heard how few we have here. I think that's extremely important to deal with. There is a void being created by the melting ice. We're going to have shipping traffic going through there in very short order. We need the ability to patrol it, or they'll be patrolling it for us. So we need to join them in filling the void. And one of the things we really, really need up here are some deep water ports. And I will speak more about why I think we need deep water ports here in a little bit.
Senator Lisa Murkowski?
Yes, we absolutely need to keep the Russians first and foremost when we think about security, but it's not just Russia, it's China. We're seeing Chinese vessels up in our northern waters. So they could be out sightseeing, they could be out doing something else, but we need to be vigilant, we need to be on the alert. And it was reported by the Russian defense minister that over in Chukotka, there's going to be a coastal defense division by the year 2018. That should get our attention. So the question then is, what do we do? We see this. We are this zone of peace. We always have operated that way. But that doesn't mean that you sit back and you do nothing and hope that everyone in the region behaves. It makes sure that you have the assets, that you act as an Arctic nation, whether it's icebreakers. And by the way, it was through my leadership on the Senate Appropriations Bill that we have full funding now for the first time ever for a full-fledged icebreaker. But it's more than icebreakers. It's having helicopters and other assets stationed in the Arctic. We have a lot to do to be prepared.
Breck, did you respond to this question?
I did, though.
Okay. No, okay, you already did. So I'm sorry. I'm out of sequence here. So we're going to go to Ray Metcalf with our next question, because he raised the issue of deep water ports. It's clear with the Arctic becoming ice-free for longer periods of the year that there's a need for infrastructure in the Arctic that we don't have. So how do we go about getting this, and what would you do if you were elected?
Well, the first thing I would do is point out to the other senators that that the Russians have all these facilities on the other side of the from us and along the Siberian coast. And the importance of the resources that they're going to tap if we don't. And I think there's it's fairly easy to ring the alarm bell and say, you know, this is an urgent need of addressing. And the other thing that I'd like to bring up is there are some ships under construction in Korea as we speak. In fact, Shell has even ordered one of them. They are the largest floating vessels ever built, much larger than the tankers that come in and out of Valdez. They are floating LNG plants. And if we can find some deep enough water here, we can take the North Slope gas directly off the slope, and it loads directly onto those ships. They process it. We won't need an 800-mile pipeline to get our gas marketed.
Senator Lisa Murkowski, infrastructure needs for the Arctic, how do we get them?
We start with making sure that we have the ability to place these ports, these deep water ports, where we need them. We were successful this year in advancing the land conveyance out of Port Clarence, deep water port opportunity for us. within the WERDA bill that will be advanced in this lame duck. We have a provision there relating to the deep water port there at Nome, and a recognition that it's not just one deep water port that we need. It is a system of ports to prepare us for the Arctic. But it's more than just ports. It's other infrastructures. It's making sure that we have charted these areas, because that has not yet been fully conducted. We have to make sure that we have appropriate navigational aids. It's important that we have the telecommunications piece. So when we're talking infrastructure for the Arctic, remember, it's more than just a place to put a ship in a safe harbor.
All right, thank you, Senator Lisa Murkowski. Brett Craig, Arctic infrastructure?
I agree with both Senator Murkowski and Ray Metcalf in this regard. I propose, as your next U.S. Senator, in the next 100 days, I will put forward a bill that is called the Emergency Arctic Infrastructure and National Security Bill, and it will appropriate funds to build the ports we need and to bring on the infrastructure belts to light up the interior, to lower our energy costs, and to bring the required infrastructure and housing and other facilities, telecommunications networks we need to get up to speed and to get ahead in the Arctic. And that's what I propose to do in the first 100 days.
Margaret?
Well, the big problem with infrastructure funding, which we all support up here, I believe we all support massive infrastructure spending in the Arctic, is that you have to pay for it. And we've had a Republican-controlled Congress that has an austerity-first philosophy where they refuse to fund infrastructure spending. The infrastructure, public construction as a percentage of GDP right now is at its record lows, historic lows. And the lack of infrastructure spending has delayed our recovery from the Great Recession in 2008, and it will lower our productivity gains in the coming decades. This austerity-first philosophy is doubly ill-considered because borrowing costs are really, really low right now. So the first step in getting all this infrastructure is to elect independents and Democrats to the Congress who will support Hillary Clinton's plan to increase infrastructure spending throughout the United States, including in the Arctic.
All right, thank you very much. We do have students here in the audience. I want to point out they're social studies and civic students. So thank you for providing a lesson today on how the American electoral process works. And we do have some students here to ask questions. So I'm going to invite one of our first student questioners to pose a question. And we will begin with Lisa Murkowski answering and Loudon Stockton posing the question. And as I understand it, the students spent quite a bit of time crafting their questions, working with their fellow students and teachers.
Yes. Thomas Jefferson, one of our founding fathers, believed that the career politician would be bad for our country. What are your takes on that?
We begin with Lisa.
A career politician probably is bad for the country, because you have to have depth and breadth as a citizen. You need to know how taxes impact a family and a business before you change tax policies. You have to have the breadth and depth of experience beyond just being a lawmaker. And so I agree with Thomas Jefferson. I think where you're going is it important that we would have term limits on our public officials? We have that here in the state on our governors. They're limited to 2 terms. We don't have that on our members of Congress. Some would say here in Alaska that we don't want to have that because as a small state with small population, we've got a pretty small delegation. Building up that seniority is important for us in the Senate as well as in the Congress.
Thank you. Breck, we go to you on the question of term limits.
I totally agree with term limits on the federal level, but as the senator pointed out, it would not be advantageous for Alaska to be the only state in the union that's encouraging its federal delegation to, you know, restrict itself to terms. It's going to take a constitutional amendment, and it's a necessary constitutional amendment. I think it should be extended also to the judiciary. Term limits are required to rejuvenate the legislature and to bring fresh blood in and to bring citizen candidates into office. Thank you.
Thank you. Margaret Stock?
I think it's a wonderful question, and I agree that the founders believed that ordinary citizens would go off to Washington, D.C. for short periods of time, serve their communities, and then return home to their successful careers in those communities. That was the intent of the Constitution. But unfortunately, we now have a system where we have career politicians. In fact, we have one with us here on the debate floor. I'm pleased to hear Senator Murkowski support the idea that she should only serve two terms in Congress, in the Senate. And she has had two terms in the Senate, and of course, I hope to replace her. I do support term limits, and I will step down after serving two terms in the United States Senate. In light of what the Founding Fathers believed, which was that people who are successful in their civilian life, as I've been a very successful attorney and military officer, should go to Washington, use their experiences to serve, and then return home to serve their communities once again.
Thank you. We'll go to Ray Metcalf.
I'm 66 today, and I promise to sit down at 78. So I do agree with term limits. I think that I've watched our senators get in there, and they go in as paupers, and they come out as multimillionaires. You know, there's really something wrong with that. Since the question was about Thomas Jefferson, I will, and his opposition to professional politicians. Thomas Jefferson also put something into the Senate rules that said effectively that if there's a conflict of interest of any sort, you cannot participate in the vote or the debate. And with that in mind, I have proposed legislation, and if I am in there, I will make sure that legislators and senators aren't voting on bills that line their pockets of their families, their employers, their self, their cousins and their relatives, and so on and so forth.
All right, thank you, Ray Metcalf. We are going to change up topics a little bit and focus on subsistence, because in most Senate debates, most statewide elections, that's not a topic that really gets its due. And here in Barrow and other communities in rural Alaska, subsistence is everything. So we'll begin with BRAC. In many communities in the Arctic, there are fears about how the Endangered Species Act might restrict subsistence activities, quotas for polar bears, bearded seals, restrictions on critical habitat. So what would you do to make sure that people continue to have subsistence opportunity?
Well, first, as your next U.S. Senator, I fully support inclusion of an indigenous analysis of all federal regulation, especially concerning subsistence issues. I think it's an outrage that Alaska Native villages have been excluded or marginalized in the entire subsistence regulation process at the federal level. There's been a lot of lip service, but there hasn't been any real participation on the part of First Alaskans in determining how the fishing quotas should be allocated, on how endangered species laws should be implemented. I think the first Alaskans were the first resource managers. They're the experts in the area in Arctic, and they should be engaged from the beginning.
Thank you. Margaret, same question.
Well, I support a rural preference on all Alaskan lands and waters, both federal and state lands and waters, and that would broaden and expand the subsistence activities throughout the state and allow for unified fish and game management. However, as you know, probably this would require an amendment to the state constitution, given the United States Supreme Court's decision in the McDowell case. And the Alaska legislature has never agreed to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot, and there hasn't been much of an effort in the Alaska legislature to do so since 2002. So I think we will need to make an amendment, and I believe that we will need to make probably an amendment also to ANILCA. I support that concept, and I do support the subsistence rights of Alaska Natives and the rights of rural residents to subsistence.
All right, thank you. Ray Metcalf?
I do support a rural subsistence preference, and there are many ways to get there. But I'm the only one on this stage, I can assure you, that fully understands subsistence. I was born on a Crow reservation. Most of my food was either we shot it, raised it in a garden, or raised our farm animals, and I ate tons of venison and moose and elk as I was growing up. That was what was on our table. So I understand that there is no cash economy in a lot of the villages. The subsistence isn't an option. It's the only way you can stay alive and subsist and live in your village.
All right. And Lisa Murkowski?
I, too, support a rural preference. I want to speak about a fear and a threat coming at us from a subsistence perspective that is really frightening right now. We just saw the opinion coming down from the Ninth Circuit related to the bearded seal. That has potential impact not only to our oil and gas opportunities offshore, but it has potential impact on subsistence hunting of the bearded seal. The polar bear, the lawsuits, the critical habitat that has been designated for the polar bear. And there are other species coming our way by way of the Endangered Species Act. So what do you do about it? I have introduced legislation that basically says no more. Under ANILCA, we said the deal was no more wilderness, no more de facto wilderness, no more creating these designations of wilderness through establishment of wilderness study areas, of critical habitat under ESA. We have got to get control, not only in this area, but utilizing the Antiquities Act and designation of monuments as well.
All right, thank you. Shortly here, we are going to be calling on Michelle Kaliak to ask a question in our subsistence round, so I want Michelle to get ready to ask her question. But while we're doing that, we'll begin with Margaret Stockton. Throughout rural Alaska, you see a push for co-management of resources. We see it on the Yukon and the Kuskokwim for management of fisheries. We see it with marine mammals. What would you do to ensure that there is more meaningful co-management opportunity for rural communities?
Well, I very much support co-management. I think it's important to have co-management, particularly in a time when the state is having its budget cut and the state, because of falling oil revenues, is no longer going to be able to afford to pay for a lot of the programs that the state has had previously. Tribal entities can step in and help out with co-management initiatives, and the ones that we've seen so far have been very successful. So I would encourage more co-management initiatives. I would encourage the United States federal government to reach out to folks in the native and rural communities to develop new programs for co-management, and I would use the ones that we've already got as models for how to do it properly in the future.
Ray Metcalf?
I do support co-management. I think that the more local the control, the better. I think that that one of the things that is needed is, and then frankly, an amendment to ANILCA to put more local control in control of the villages. The more local the control is, I think the more subsistence is protected and. So that's my answer.
All right, thank you. Lisa Murkowski?
Thank you. Co-management around the state is something that I do believe that we need to be looking to make sure that the management of our fish, of our game, of our marine mammals is more effectively managed for the benefit and use of Alaskans. OTNA is working with us as well as the federal land managers to build just this type of a co-management plan for our game in the interior. Along the Yukon and the Kuskokwim, the Intertribal Fish Commission, good examples of ways that we can be working cooperatively together. Here in the Arctic, the Nanuk Commission working with Fish and Wildlife to make sure that any regulations that would advance related to our polar bears are ones that, again, work to the beneficial use of those people within the region.
Thank you. Rick?
I also believe in co-management. I think it's essential, and it's been a huge oversight. And in injustice to date. I think one of the reasons that the Yukon-Kuskokwim co-management effort is having challenges because they don't have a permanent source of funding. And I think that's one of the things that, as your next senator, I will ensure gets put in place so that they have a permanent source of funding and that funding's available to spawn other co-management regimes around the state. Thank you.
All right, our next question is going to come from Michelle Kaliak. Are you ready, Michelle?
Barrow is a proud whaling community. The quota for hunting the bowhead whale is on the agenda for renewal during the 2018 International Whaling Commission. How will you work to ensure that communities of this region will continue to be able to hunt the bowhead whale?
And we begin with Ray Metcalf.
Vote to ensure that they can. And I see no need for any changes. You know, when a whale captain brings in a whale, they share it with all of the community. And I think there's something to be thought of here with respect to the native corporations. The native corporations were a giant whale for this area. And I'm watching a growing divide in these communities. I'm seeing a few people get very rich and a lot of people feeling left out. And so I think that the native corporations and the people at the helm of those need to take a lesson from the whaling captains and learn to share.
Lisa Murkowski.
I've been working with the AEWC as well as the International Eskimo Whaling Commission over my tenure in the United States Senate to make sure that the quota in the Arctic here in the U.S. is not diminished, that the subsistence that the people of the North rely on can continue. But that means not only explaining to others why whaling is such an integral part of our life and our culture here, we have to explain it to those within our own country. Sometimes those in the State Department are not as favorable to this as we would like. Pushing back against the Japanese who are seeking a quota, and the politics of quota is something that is often fought in warm places far away, but we have been engaged with the fight every time this comes up for negotiation, and we've been successful in keeping our quota for our native people.
Brett Craig, it's your turn to answer Michelle Kaliak's question. And by the way, she told me that she works on a whaling crew. So we have a very authentic questioner here. Brett, 1 minute.
Well, I'd like to be on that whaling crew one of these days. I think it'd be a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I, too, like I believe everybody on the stage, supports Alaska Natives' rights to whaling and subsistence lifestyle. I think one of the things that needs to happen going forward next year, the Magnuson-Stevens Fisheries Conservation Act is up for renewal, and there needs to be much stronger enforceable language about subsistence lifestyles and communities having preference on natural resources ahead of commercial interest. I think that's been ignored, it needs to be corrected. And we also need to do baseline studies that need to be led by Alaska Natives on what's happening in the Arctic with the whale population, with the minks, with the narwhals and the killer whales. I mean, I think there's a lot of base science that needs to be done.
All right, thank you very much. Margaret Stock.
I appreciate the subsistence lifestyle that folks north of the Arctic Circle engage in, and I'll work to protect their right to hunt the bowhead whales. I think the larger threat to the whales at the moment, though, comes from the opening up of the Arctic, because we are now seeing shipping lanes that might be open and that will threaten the whales. We're seeing climate change happening that might threaten the whales. And so we need to continue to research and study and integrate indigenous knowledge into the science that we're learning about the migration patterns of the whales and the numbers of whales available. My job as a senator will be to gather that information and educate people, including people on the International Whaling Commission, to talk to them about the needs of Alaska Natives and the historical practices that they've had over the centuries.
All right, and I want to just get Jay Balanza ready. She's a student here who will be asking a question in this segment round, so will you prepare to ask the question? So I'm going to ask this question of all of you. Is if pretend that I am a senator that represents Chicago. That's my main district. So what I would like you to do is talk to me and make me understand subsistence and tell me why I need to care about these people I may never see or even care about. Lisa, 1 minute.
Subsistence is more than just food. Subsistence is a culture, it is a spirit, it is a people, an identity to a people. And so when you think about harvesting a whale, it is not just a marine mammal that gives itself for the meat. It is a part of the culture of sharing, of working together, of pulling together as a people, and then sharing the benefits throughout. Subsistence is a way of life. And I think far too often, people on the outside think it is just about putting food on the table. It is absolutely an identity to a people, a spirituality to a people that needs to be experienced.
Breck, make your argument to me. I'm a hard sell.
Well, Senator, what you need to know about the subsistence lifestyle in Alaska is that it is imbued in the culture of Alaskans and First Alaskans. It has been with them from the beginning for millennia. And it's much more than just about hunting and fishing. It's about a very way of life. And because now, especially, you have the opportunity to participate in what's the new Alaska, which is going to become a world and global power in this new era. And your support and understanding will be recognized and it will be appreciated by those who will be leading us all into the future. And if you don't vote for it, I'm not going to vote for any of yours.
Thank you, Breck. Margaret?
Well, there's an old saying that if you give a man a fish, he only eats one meal, and if you teach him to fish, he fishes for a lifetime. And I think it's important to remind people of that saying and point out that subsistence lifestyle really is teaching somebody to live for their entire life. It is a culture. It is a way of life. It's existed for thousands of years, and it prevents government from having to give people handouts. It's a full lifestyle. We don't always monetize it. We don't value it the same way that we value an ordinary job in the cash economy, but it should be valued that way. And frankly, I don't think the word is a good one. Subsist sounds like you're just barely getting along. I think they should change it to sustenance, because that is really what it's all about, spiritual, cultural, and it's a much richer way of life than you might experience in the cash economy in Chicago.
Thank you. One more response, Ray Metcalf.
You know, many years ago when I was in the legislature, I was talking about my growing up on the reservation and subsistence and so on. And I got up and gave a little speech on some people that were saying, some of the urban folks that were saying they need to help pay for their schools out there. And I said, with what? And, looking at it from the perspective of somebody growing up in a village, you know, there is no cash economy. It's a subsistence. That's how they live. That's where they get their subsistence from. And explaining that to people that the economy is subsistence of those communities, that's the way to get their attention. I agree with everything that Lisa said. It's cultural. But in terms of getting people's attention, you need to explain to them that that is the economy. You don't have cash left over to pay for schools. You have the fish and the game and the bounty of the...
All right. Thank you very much, Ray Metcalf. We're going to begin our next round of questioning with Breck Craig, and we have a student questioner, Jay Balanza.
With so many fatal shootings in our country, there's a push for more gun control. Do you support this?
Okay, her question is, we've had so many fatal shootings in our nation. Do you support gun control?
I absolutely support gun control. I'm a big advocate of the Second Amendment. As a former U.S. Marine, I know how to handle a weapon, but I also believe that we need to make sure that firearms are in the hands of responsible people. I think that, especially in very urban, dense areas, it's particularly important that you don't have a lot of handguns around, especially high caliber, semi-automatic weapons. I mean, there's just too many people. It's a very difficult experience for us up here in Alaska, where we actually use our firearms to hunt. You know, in an urban environment, it's solely for protection or it's a sport. And they need to be, there needs to be a distinction made. And things need to be a lot more tight in these urban environments than they are up here. But
all right, thank you. Thank you, Breck. Margaret?
I'm a strong supporter of the Second Amendment, and I'm a gun owner. I was also a military police officer for 28 years in the Army Reserve, and I carried a firearm on duty. I'm an Alaskan, and I have a cabin in a remote part of Alaska, and I carry a firearm there for personal protection and also for hunting and, you know, in case there's no law enforcement around to protect me against the bears. But I do believe that it's important for us to make sure that we close some of the loopholes that prevent people who are mentally ill, criminals and terrorists, that allow them to get access to firearms and create a public safety threat to the rest of our folks. I think we can do that, and I think the first step in doing that is to allow the Center for Disease Control to start studying gun violence in America. Alaska is leading the nation in gun deaths, and it's pretty bad, and we need to start studying that and trying to figure out a way to solve that problem.
Ray Metcalf?
You know, there's a saying you hear from the NRA all the time, and it says, if you outlaw guns, only criminals will have guns. And I agree with that. I think that's very true. I grew up in a community where we had literally dozens of guns in the house. They were for game. And I never remember a time when I didn't have access to a gun in my entire life. As a child, the first time I wanted to play with a gun, my dad took me out back and said, here's how you use it. He didn't try to stop me. But aside from that, you know, I think the NRA has some crazy ideas, too. You know, there was a whole bunch of people shot in a nightclub in Florida, and the person had been under investigation. And there should have been an alert alerting local authorities that somebody who had been under investigation for potential terrorist activities had just purchased several semi-automatic weapons and several thousand rounds of ammo. That should have been an alert to somebody somewhere.
Senator Lisa Murkowski?
I think we all agree here that protecting the Second Amendment is something that we will all stand behind. And as a gun owner myself, I not only understand and value that, but I also value the education that we have passed on to our children in making sure that they understand the lethality of a firearm when it is used carelessly or improperly. Making sure that we do not have guns in the hands of those who should not, whether they are the terrorists or those that are mentally ill. We need to do better in this area. We've actually advanced some pretty good legislation that would help address the issue of mental health. But I think we also in this room know that far too often the firearm gets in the hands of someone who's passed a background check. There's no problem there, but alcohol or some substance abuse has been involved. We have to address this as an issue because this is what is killing our people.
All right, thank you. All right, we begin our next round with Margaret Stock, an independent candidate. And this one is fun. We're gonna just have a little breather here. We've been serious. 30 seconds to answer this. What's your favorite subsistence food? Or if you don't know, what one would you like to try?
Muktuk.
All right.
I've tried it, and I like it.
All right, Ray Metcalf?
I tried muktuk once, and that was it. I like moose. Moose, caribou, I like red meat. So that's it.
Senator Lisa Murkowski?
A gouda, because I like the berries in it.
And Breck Craig?
I'd like to try muktuk.
I'm sorry.
I'd like to try muktuk as well.
Muktuk, okay. Yeah. All right, so now we're going to go on to science. And, of course, In the arena of science, nothing figures more importantly than climate change, and they say that the Arctic is the front lines of climate change. So we're going to begin with Ray Metcalf on this subject. Because there are so many expenses involved in adapting to climate change, from moving people to all the food security issues that arise, who should pay for this adaptation process?
You know, there were some people who live in towers in London at the top of BP. They got very rich exploiting the burning of fossil fuels, and they are vested in burning more fossil fuels. And I think that the people that got rich bringing about all this global warming are the people that need to pay for moving the villages that are being eroded away by the lack of sea ice protecting their shores, etc. You know, the people that caused the problem need to pay for the problem.
Lisa? The threats are very real. We see it every day. You see it here in Barrow and all around our northern coast. So who does pay for it? There's a lot of talk about what needs to happen and who is going to pay. We're going to have a grand infrastructure program if Secretary Clinton is elected, supposedly, but how do you pay for that? Who are we taxing for that? What I have suggested is what we do is we implement a level of revenue sharing that will allow us here in Alaska to be able to access additional resources, whether onshore or offshore, and from those revenues, we create a tribal resilience fund. That tribal resilience fund is available for everything from relocation of villages to making sure that communities' needs are met to ensuring that a level of adaptation of infrastructure can move forward. We can pay if we have such a resilience fund established that has real money and real dollars behind it. Rack?
I like what Senator Murkowski said about tribal resilience funds. I have a big concern with the fact, I think this is just a huge problem. It's going to require tens of billions of dollars. There are hundreds of villages and towns in Alaska and along the Arctic that are going to be impacted by this and along the rivers. We're going to need, I think, a program on the scale of a Tennessee River Valley effort that we saw in the 30s. It's going to require funds from international organizations as well as federal and state. It needs to be a very aggressive and quick, rapid implementation fund. We don't have any more time. We waited too long. You know, we've waited to the last moment, once again, to do anything about it. And now we're faced with, it's here. Climate change is here. And we have to do things, you know, now. I think it's a very big effort.
Margaret? Well, I will vigorously advocate for federal mitigation funds, including a waiver of the federal matching fund requirements for projects that are necessitated by climate change. But to be direct, the federal government is not going to have enough money to fully mitigate the huge costs of climate change in Alaska. We're talking about $1 million per person in Kivalina to relocate, and Kivalina will be underwater in the next 10 years. So we're going to have to figure out how to deal with this problem, which includes reducing the pace of climate change, including supporting the Paris Agreement, to an agreement that was supported by 195 nations, and opposing efforts to stop the Environmental Protection Agency from subsidizing clean energy. But I do want to mention that on the revenue sharing, I support Mark Begich's bill that would have provided 37.5% revenue sharing to Alaska and direct 25% of that to Alaska Native Village and regional corporations. Lisa Murkowski proposed a bill that would provide less revenue sharing in Alaska, 22.5%, than Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama would get.
Okay, and we will get to the topic of oil revenue sharing later as we move into the development round of questioning. But we want to begin with Lisa Murkowski on this question. I am Senator X, and I only know what it's like to drive my BMW down the freeways of L.A., and I have no clue about life in the Arctic, and my suggestion to you in a committee hearing was that why not just move everybody to Anchorage? Why not just close down that village if it's going to cost so dang much to move people?
You are eroding the underpinning of Alaska if the answer is to move rural Alaska to the urban centers. We should not accept that. I will not accept that. Now, yes, we recognize it's more expensive to live here in Barrow. It's more expensive to live in Atkasak or New Ixit or Kaktovik. But this is where people have been living for thousands of years. So our challenge should not be fold up the tents and tell everybody to move to town. Our challenge should be how do we make our energy costs more affordable? How can we work to ensure that we're tapping into the ingenuity that will bring about cost efficiencies in a place where it is challenging, where it is hard? Well, we're doing it here. Look to what we are doing in terms of leadership. Don't just say, everybody, pack up your bags and move to the city. That's what they might do in California. That's not what we're going to do in Alaska.
Rick, it's your turn. I know which senator you were talking about.
Senator, once again, you have the opportunity to be part of the solution in Alaska. These Alaskan villages and towns have been there for a millennia. They are the first Alaskans. They are the keepers of the land. They're no more going to move into the cities than you're going to move to the moon. As well, these Alaskan villages and towns, if we do this right, will become thriving towns and cities in the future because of the bounty that surrounds them. We need to drive infrastructure into the towns and villages. We need to build roads into the interior. I need your help to fund this because Alaska's the future. Alaska is the guiding star for America in the coming years, and you have the chance to be part of that.
Thank you, Breck. Margaret?
People have lived in this area for more than 10,000 years and created a unique and sustainable lifestyle, much more sustainable than the lifestyle in Chicago or Boston or Washington, D.C. over a long period of time. I would invite folks who doubt the value of that lifestyle to come out here and visit and experience and see whether they really want everybody who experiences the unique lifestyle here to move to another place. I would invite them to come out and see it themselves, and then I would remind them that America is a wonderfully diverse country that has lots of different lifestyles that are unique and precious because of the nature of their lifestyle. And they must be preserved just as much as other unique lifestyles elsewhere in Maine or Texas or California or some other place. Alaska is very special and very unique, and there is value in that unique lifestyle that should not be underestimated.
Thank you. Ray?
You know, every now and again I find myself reminding an urbanite that their dividend came out from under the feet of those folks living in the Arctic, and they deserve a fair share. In fact, someone living in the Arctic might ask, why are they getting a share of what came out from under our feet? But in any case, you know, if you look at every major city in the world, there's an industry outside that city that supports that city. And what industry does Anchorage have? Not much. It is the bedroom community for all of Alaska, for its industry. The machines of Alaskan industry are here. They're all over Alaska. And so the problem with bringing too much into Anchorage, if Anchorage ever has an absolute majority in both houses of the legislature, they will take it all. In fact, they'll destroy themselves by virtue of destroying the reason for being.
All right, thank you. So let's move on to the economy and development, and of course tourism is a part of that. And this year, communities along the coast witnessed something very historic, a huge ship carrying tourists across the Arctic, transiting it, something that a ship of its size has never done before. So here we are on the precipice of big change here. Arctic waters, as they stay clear for more of the year free of ice, present opportunities and dangers, two sides of a coin. So we'll begin with Breck on your analysis of what these challenges and opportunities mean.
Well, there's certainly a lot of challenges and opportunities. I don't think we can stop cruise ships from traveling international waters through the Northwest Passage. Obviously, the infrastructure required to respond to an emergency isn't there. The cruise ship that came through, the inaugural ship that went through recently, had a standby boat lead it all the way through. That's not going to happen in the future. We do have a lot of work to do to get emergency facilities, docks, and to take advantage of being able to have those cruise ships stop in Arctic ports to visit these towns to spread the wealth. But it's going to take a lot of work, and it's a lot of work, once again, that needs to happen in a very short order.
All right. Thank you very much. Margaret Stock?
Well, it does represent an opportunity, and it also represents danger. We, of course, when we have large cruise ships coming through, it's a possibility to educate the folks on the cruise ship about communities like Barrow so they will value them more and presumably not ask their residents to relocate to Chicago. The cruise ships wouldn't want to come up here if there were no place to stop for them to experience a blanket toss or visit the local people or find out about subsistence hunting and fishing. So there's some opportunities in terms of tourism, great opportunities, but there's also some dangers. Right now, we're facing the possibility that fishing in the Arctic might happen, and it would be unregulated at the moment because we don't have a regime, and that could deplete the resource. We also see potential threats to the bowhead whale. We see the possibility of spills in the Arctic, rescue missions needed in the Arctic. So we have to be vigilant and recognize that with this opportunity of the ice going away, there are also great dangers, and we're going to need to plan for it.
Ray Metcalf?
I touched on the subject earlier. I think this is an opportunity that we might be able to get the federal government to come in and help us build a giant deep water port, large enough to handle those giant ships that are being constructed as we speak, and relieve us of the risk of paying for a pipeline that might not pay for itself once finished. We don't know what the price of gas is going to be 10 years from now when that comes online. So if we are able to get the federal government to participate in the construction of a giant port that would handle those liquid or LNG, floating LNG plants that can receive our gas directly off the slope in its raw form, process it on board, take it away, we won't have to pay for a gas line. And make that, we won't have to risk the experiment of doing that. And we can get the federal government to actually pay for part of what it takes to get the gas out of here.
Lisa Murkowski.
On the opportunities side, tourism clearly brings jobs and economic opportunity as well as educational opportunities. It helps us to advance the necessary infrastructure that we need. That, too, brings about jobs and opportunities for the people here. And when you have all this, then the telecom side comes out. We're seeing this with the Quintillion project, broadband coming that's going to connect us to the rest of the world. This wouldn't come if all these other things were not coming into place at the same time. On the challenges side of it, though, the search and rescue capability, we know we have to do more. We must make sure that the Coast Guard has the infrastructure, whether it's icebreakers, or whether it's national security cover, whether it's OPCs, FRCs, whatever they may be. We also need to be working with the AEWC, with our whaling captains, and our Coast Guard to make sure that there's a level of communication. Right now, the Coast Guard Command Center and the whalers are not able to talk about who's out in the water. We need to work on that, and we're helping to facilitate that in my office now.
And just before we go on to the next question, I do want to ask one of our student questioners to prepare, Mabel Kaliak. She'll be asking the next question. Margaret, do you want to end this round?
I already addressed that.
Oh, you already addressed it? So I'm sorry. I guess I got out of turn here. I guess Breck is the last.
No, you started.
I started.
Oh, okay. So we'll go ahead. We'll begin with Margaret, and we're going to shift to our last question on oil and gas development, and Mabel will have that question for you.
Since many of you support oil exploration, what will you do to protect the Arctic from oil spills?
Okay, and let's see, where are we? I got a little bit lost in this.
I think I started.
You started, so we go to Margaret.
Could you read the first part of the question again?
What will you do to protect the Arctic from oil spills?
Well, you've pointed out a very significant problem, that which is that it's probably inevitable if we drill for oil and gas in the Arctic that we will have a spill at some point. So in order to protect the Arctic, first, we have to put measures in place to try to prevent a spill from happening. We have some of those in place right now, but as you know, they were getting ready to vote on opening up the Arctic to oil drilling when the Exxon Valdez spill happened in 1989. And of course, people were shocked and horrified to discover that the impacts that oil had on Prince William Sound when it was spilled. So what we need to do are to put safeguards in place, technology such as the valves that prevent blowouts like the Deepwater Horizon. We need to have regulation to make sure that we don't have companies spilling chemicals into the environment like happened in the Flint Hills refinery near Fairbanks, where 1,500 people now have polluted drinking water. So I will fund measures for Arctic oil response, more Coast Guard assets, and more safeguards to prevent oil spills.
Ray Metcalf?
Many years ago, in the 60s and 70s, I worked as a driller up there on the roughneck on the North Slope, did a little bit of drilling, worked on the Cook Inlet. I know this business. I know the oil field industry. I have watched our legislators being bribed and cajoled to lessen the protection, when the Exxon Valdez hit the rocks, we weren't ready, and we weren't ready because too many legislators had let their guard down, and they had taken the money, and so on and so forth, and we weren't on guard. So we need good federal statutes to keep them on their toes that won't be relaxed by lobbying. Also, Shell was drilling outside of the 3-mile limit, and we don't get any of those royalties. I see no reason to support risking what that risks to the whalers and the subsistence people living in Alaska when we don't even get a royalty.
Senator Lisa Murkowski?
We have some of the highest standards in the world when it comes to oil production here in the state of Alaska. We see that onshore. We've seen that not only from Prudhoe 40 years ago, but to our newer fields. And I think we do have a track record of which, as Alaskans, we should be proud. But we expect it to be that way. We expect you to operate without harm to the environment. We expect you to use the best available technology, the highest standards. Offshore is greater uncertainty, and I think we recognize that. And there's greater concern there about the potential for a spill. But keep in mind, there too, since the 80s, we have successfully and safely had exploratory operations in the Beaufort and in the Chukchi. We need to make sure, though, that it's not just the U.S. that is working this. We have oil spill prevention that we have been working with our other Arctic partners through the Arctic Council to ensure that what happens in our section of the Arctic doesn't impact others or vice versa.
So we go to the independent candidate, Rex Craig.
Thank you. I worked my way through college on offshore oil rigs. My whole family's oil, going way back. I was supposed to be an oil man, but I'm not. The U.S. oil industry is the safest in the world. We wrote the book on oil safety. It's hard to realize they've learned the lessons of even the Deepwater Horizon blow, and obviously from Valdez. The cost of failure or from an oil spill to an oil company can be measured in the tens of billions of dollars now. With that said, and with the new find off of the coast here, there isn't any oil spill response facility in place yet, and I'm sure people are looking at it and working on it, but it needs to be put in place, and it needs to be put in place soon. And we've got the Russians on the other side, as you know, running large tankers up and down their coast, and they have no oil spill recovery mechanisms in place.
Okay, I thank you very much. We have about 10 minutes left in our debate. Just to let people know, we'll be wrapping up at about 1:40 since we started about 10 minutes after 12. And one more question on oil and gas development. Other states get revenue sharing from offshore oil development. We don't. So we'll begin with Ray Metcalf, 45 seconds. What would you do to help us get a piece of the pie?
Well, first of all, I'd say until we get a fair share from the offshore outside of state waters, leave it in the ground.
Senator Murkowski?
The Gulf of Mexico states currently enjoy the benefits of revenue sharing. I have been working this issue for years now. You got to get the votes in order to get the revenue sharing. And if it's just Alaska arguing for ourselves, it's a heavier lift, and we recognize that. So I've teamed together with colleagues from the Atlantic seaboard states because they, too, are interested in gaining revenue sharing. What I want to do is put the benefit to those states that bear the responsibility. And I have been working to advance this and gaining partnership in the United States Senate to effectuate revenue sharing to Alaska and to other producing states around the country.
Brett Craig?
Yeah, I too agree with revenue sharing. It doesn't make any sense for the state to bear the burden and the risk of oil development without sharing in the revenue. And if indeed it's a 3-mile limit, that needs to be addressed. It should be at the federal level, almost a national standard for what revenue sharing is. And just to get back to what Colonel Stock said earlier about the Law of the Sea Treaty, I don't know if everybody realizes, but Russia is actually trying to claim, because that treaty hasn't been ratified, that their boundaries extend to the edge of their continental shelf, which is past the North Pole. So it's significant.
Margaret Stock.
Well, Senator Murkowski's been in office for more than 12 years now and has been unable to get a bill through that would provide equitable revenue sharing. She'll tell you now that if you reelect her, she'll try harder next time, but I have my doubts. Alaska receives no revenue sharing beyond the 6-mile limit, but beginning in 2017, Gulf states of Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama will be getting 37.5% revenue sharing from production throughout the Outer Continental Shelf, and Alaska should receive equal treatment. Senator Murkowski proposed a bill that only provides 22.5% revenue sharing to Alaska, and the bill provides for a further division of that 22.5% between various Alaska interests, which don't include any Alaska Native entities. I support legislation that was proposed by Senator Mark Begich, and he has endorsed me, which provides 37.5% revenue sharing to Alaska and directs 25% of those funds to Alaska Native villages and regional corporations and 10% to tribal organizations.
All right, one last final question, and then we will go to your closing statements. And you have 30 seconds to answer this. We'll begin with Lisa Murkowski. Is the glass half full or half empty for the Arctic?
It's absolutely full. The potential for us here, because of the resource, because of the resiliency, because of the ingenuity, the perseverance of the people that make up the Arctic, it is absolutely full. We have challenges, but think about it. The people in the Arctic have faced the most extreme environmental challenges practically anywhere on planet Earth for thousands of years, and they are still here. Anybody that would suggest that it's all gloom and doom, they have not looked to these people.
All right, thank you. Brett Craig?
The glass is definitely half full. I believe with all my heart that Alaska is on the forefront of a new era, and we will be the leaders in this era. We will be a guiding light for the entire country. We have so much potential, and our resources in the state, both human capital as well as natural resources, will propel us into a real global might, in my opinion.
Margaret Stockton?
Well, the glass used to be full, but then we didn't properly plan for the future, and climate change affected us. And now I would say it's half full, but I'm a very optimistic person, and I know that with the right investment in education and in new technology, and in particularly in renewable resources, the glass in the Arctic can be full once again. This will require careful planning and leadership in Washington.
Ray Metcalf.
Alaska is a giant storehouse of resources, and the most important thing the folks in this room need to do is make sure that when someone comes along and says, if you give me access to your resources, I'll give you a job, you look them back in the eye and say, no, you pay me what I need, what my resources are worth, and I probably won't need a job. You know, when I was a kid, my grandfather had a cow, and my grandfather loved that cow, and every day that cow gave him some milk. And that went on for years and years and years. One day that cow quit giving milk, and my grandfather ate that cow. So that's the way you should look at those oil companies. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Now we come to the conclusion of our debate, and you each have 1 minute for a closing statement. We begin with Breck Craig, an independent candidate.
Thank you very much. And again, thank you very much for having me. It's been a real honor. As a citizen candidate, this is my first debate. 4 months ago, you couldn't have told me I would have been up here. I believe we're entering a new era. I believe the age of oil, which has been over 100 years, and all the incredible benefits it's afforded us as Alaskans and as humans, is coming to a close. I think there's a new age of information and of the internet. I believe we'll always need oil and the incredible products it needs, but as Alaskans, and especially as first Alaskans, I believe that it's time for us to prepare to transition to this new economy, this new era. I think we'll be on the forefront of this era in the Arctic. As a professional technologist with global work experience, and as an unaffiliated independent politician, I believe I can represent Alaska unfettered, not controlled by anybody, to be most effective for you. Thank you.
Margaret Stock, also an independent candidate.
Thank you. Utkarvik, formerly known as Barrow, thank you for hosting this debate. This is my campaign's second trip up here in as many months, and your hospitality has been wonderful. I think it's important to go back to the key points that I made in my opening statement. As I predicted, there's a lot of agreement among the candidates up here on the stage about what we need to do in the Arctic. We need greater Coast Guard presence for protection of shipping and the environment and U.S. fishing interests. We need port infrastructure, designated shipping lanes, and aids to navigation. We need buffer areas and assured cleanup capacity so the shipping does not impact native subsistence harvest. And we need to pass the Law of the Sea Treaty, which we're following anyway, so that we have a seat at the table when other nations in the world make decisions about the Arctic. But the huge stumbling block here is Congress. Congress is dysfunctional because of the hyper-partisanship and the flood of corporate special interest money. Alaska needs effective leadership, and I'm in this race because I will provide effective leadership.
Thank you.
I'm running as an independent, and I would appreciate your vote on November 8th.
Thank you, Margaret Stock. Ray Metcalf, the Democratic candidate.
You know, some of you may have grabbed one of those million-dollar bills laying on the table out there, or my friend Vernon, if you haven't got one, see Vernon, he's got plenty. One of the things it says on that million-dollar bill is not for sale, and that means to the corporations here as well. I think there are some changes needed, the changes to ANSCA that need to take place. We need transparency in corporations. Every shareholder has a right to run for office, be on that board, on a level playing field. Every shareholder should know what their corporation is doing. Every shareholder should be able no one should be left out, and there's not a level playing field. I'm seeing a few people get rich, and a lot of people beginning to feel left out. We need to fix that. It is essential to the long-term survival of your community that everybody be included. You need to share the whale.
Lisa Murkowski, the Republican candidate and the incumbent.
Thank you. We recognize that the Arctic is unique, but in so many ways, there's no difference up here. The people of the Arctic want their children to do well in school. They want to have jobs. They want to have economic opportunity. They want to have decent health care. They want to be safe in their homes. This is what I've been doing for you in the years that I've been representing you, working for you in the United States Senate. You know how often I come here. You know that I come to your hospitals. You know that I came to the old one and I was here to celebrate the ribbon cutting for the new one. You know that I have been looking at how we build out our infrastructure, pushing our Coast Guard, pushing our energy partners to do more so that the people here in this region can stand to benefit, so that the people in Alaska can stand to benefit. I'm honored to serve you, and I would respectfully ask for your vote on November 8th. Kuinakpak.
That concludes our debate. We want to thank the candidates for being here and our audience and those who are listening on KBRW and other public radio stations across the state, as well as KTVA's Facebook live stream. It's been really exciting to be a part of this historic debate, the first in the Arctic. And so the most important thing now that we've heard a lot about these issues is to remember to go out and vote. Make it all count. Thanks very much.